I'm here in the town hall in Tala, and I'm talking to Roderick Kernan. Now, Roderick, you've got a very interesting story to tell. You were born in 1928. You were the founder, or at least one of the people, I suppose, who worked as a Secretary of Science, isn't it?
Secretary of Science in the Royal Irish Academy, that's correct.
And you went on to do some publishing, but we'll start with your early days. Where did you grow up?
Well, I was born on the north side in a place called Sunnybank Nursing Home, which is on Botanic Avenue, and it's now a hotel or a pub, I'm not sure which, but it started as a nursing home.
Oh, what about your background? What was your father doing?
Well, my father was, he was working in the ESB, and he wanted us all to go there to, if we got enough honours in our exams and so on. But he worked in the ESB. My mother, my father was, his family was, I would say, establishment in a way. They're not Republicans or anything like that, whereas my mother's family were on the south side, were Republicans, and they were my grandfather, Hickey. He married a Hickey, and Grandfather Hickey worked on the railway. He was an engine driver, and that's where they lived in Inchicore. So it turned out that when my father and mother were married, and I was the eldest of the family of six, five boys and one girl, we did move from north to south a few times. We started at the south side, and then we went to the north side. We lived in Glasnevin for a while, and then we came back to Rialto, and we lived Rialto most of our lives. That is between the two canals there, Rialto Bridge. With the
And you went to school locally there?
We went to school, I just started school in Rialto National School. But my father was very keen that we go and work, study with the Christian Brothers. So we went down to the St. Teresa's, which is Donora, called Donora Avenue, and it's in the Liberties. And from there, that was the primary school. I hated primary school, and I was slightly dyslexic and left-handed, and a teacher, I had a teacher from Kerry who was determined to teach me Irish, which was a very difficult for him job. I think he had it in for the people from the Pale, actually. It's a funny thing, but unless you spoke Irish or played the harmonica. That's a curious thing about the school was they had a wind charger on the roof, which at that time, that would have been about mid-1930s, I suppose. It was very unusual in Dublin, but the wind charger was to keep radios going in all classrooms, or the extensions, loudspeakers and that, so that when he took the harmonica band into town to play on the radio, Radio Éireann, the class would be able to hear them. So he looked after the wind generator. I think it was his main interest in life, apart from being a member of the LSF, local security force.
Well, when you were, I suppose, those colourful days of school, just staying with that, the radio was relatively new at the time, so it was over the GPO, wasn't it?
It wasn't the GPO, yes. And quite a few people that went past through that school finished up the GPO and finished up in RE, including Gay Byrne. He was a few years behind me. He lived just a few doors from us in Rialto. There were other people like, I can't think of the names now, but I'm sure that, what's his name? Well, I can't think of the names now at the moment, but there were a number of people who went into the either journalism or radio. Coburn was a chap who passed through there, I'm sure.
Why do you think that? Was it just a coincidence?
Well, I don't know. It probably was just a coincidence. The radio was starting up at the time, and they just happened to be interested in that medium, I suppose.
Could you tell me, as soon as you finished with school, did you go right through? Did you do something?
Well, I went to secondary. Oh, yes. We moved down from Donora Avenue to Sing Street, which, in my opinion, was a marvellous experience for me, because I immediately started to study science. And I had a science teacher there, second to none. He realised that most people are not interested in science. So he arranged that the first two rows in the classroom were occupied by people interested in it. And I learned more science. I never learned as much science with him as I learned in the whole of my undergraduate course in UCD. And that's not saying that I didn't learn something there, but I learned a hell of a lot of organic chemistry, which wasn't usual for somebody leaving school. And this is where the most important step in my life came about, because when I left school, I didn't get enough honours to go to the ESB. My father got in touch with the school and got in touch with the superior in the school and discovered that there was a vacancy in UCD in the Medical Research Council under Vincent Barry, Dr. Vincent Barry, who came from Cork originally, I think, for somebody to wash the glassware. And I went down to do that. And I was replacing a chap named Fergus Hill. It was really to save my fees. My parents said they could send me to college if I could earn my fees, but they couldn't afford to keep me and send me to college. So I went to work with Barry for a year. Fergus Hill had worked with him for 3 years. Fergus Hill, by the way, became state pathologist, I think, or state chemist. And I went and took his place then with Barry. At that time, the fees went up from £28 a year to 40-something. And I thought, oh, my God, I had given in my notice at the end of the year. And I said, I won't have enough money. And he said, well, if you pass your exams in first science, he said, you can come back and work with me. And I'll give you a project to work on, a serious project, because we have to prepare a substance for use in a leprosy colony. And he said, we have to, because the tubercle bacillus, which was what he was working on the chemotherapy of tuberculosis, and now he had a compound which proved effective against leprosy. So I got the job of coming in and working for the summer, after my summer exam, which I passed. And
What age were you at this stage? You were still early 20s?
Well, I would have been about... No, I wouldn't be in my early 20s. I hadn't really started school, so I'd be 18 or 19 or something like that.
So quite a young lad for quite an important
Well, it was a great experience. Task, yeah. It was a great experience for me. My notebooks had to be given to a second or third year student. I think it was a graduate student. Got my notebooks to continue the synthesis, because although I worked for the summer and got enough for a test, it proved successful as far as I know, and they wanted more of the compound. So this girl was employed then as a graduate to prepare more of the compound. So I had the pleasure then of meeting postgraduate people and staff even before I was even a student in college, which was a great experience for me. When I came to college to study chemistry, I thought I could just study chemistry and that was it. I didn't realize you had to take a few subjects. And when I was my second year, I was exposed to biochemistry for the first time. First year you studied science. You studied the science subjects of physics, maths, chemistry, and biology. And in the second year, then you dropped one subject and you could take another subject if you wish. And I decided I'd go mainly for the chemistry, with biochemistry and botany as second and third. I'd like to have done physics, but the professor of botany happened to be dean of the faculty at the time and persuaded me I'd be better off to study botany. And it turned out at the end of the story that was the right decision. Because I finished up working at biology in the academy, which is what my present job is. I'm on a committee called the New Survey of Clare Island. The original survey was carried out 100 years ago by a chap named Lloyd Prager, who studied first of all Lambay Island and then Clare Island, which is in Clew Bay in the west of Ireland. Now, these were pristine environments where they looked at everything from the local history to the geology, archaeology, and the biology of the islands.
And how soon after your qualifications did you actually get that appointment with the Royal Irish Academy?
Oh, well, it's not easy to join the Royal Irish Academy, and I have to say that I'm sorry there are not more biologists in the academy. There are certain groups there that are better represented. Let's say the mathematicians and chemists are very strong in the academy. And the more people you have as members, the more likely you are to get more of your type in. So biologists and earth sciences, that's geology and biology, generally are poorly represented, in my opinion, in the academy. But I happen to know Vincent Barry, and I have to say that I don't think I would have been able to join as quickly if it weren't for the fact that he was, I think he was treasurer of the academy at the time, and advised me to apply, and I suppose he probably was able to get a few names to sign my application. At the moment, at that time, there were only 8 people elected to the academy each year, and 4 in the humanities and 4 in the sciences. It was a very restricted entry, and it wasn't suitable for the number of scientists who were coming on stream at that time.
And was it important to know somebody to get in?
Well, I believe it helps. I have to say it helps, but you have to have other qualifications. I'm not saying it's the only means of getting in. I suppose I probably would have got in eventually, but I think it certainly speeded things up for me.
Yeah, but the preference, I suppose, was there because, you know, because of your contact.
Well, yeah, but I again, Barry had a high regard for me, I suppose, because I had been helpful, useful to him. And that's why he would have proposed me, or I think, I'm not sure whether he did propose to me, but certainly he signed my certificate for application for membership.
What year was it when you entered?
At the Academy, 1961.
And what was your first, what was your brief? What were you doing?
Well, you enter as a member, and if you're lucky, you may become a vice president. 2 presidents in the Academy invited me to be vice president. And with one of, I had the experience of, the purpose of the vice president was, if the president wasn't available, you had to chair a meeting of the Academy. And I had the pleasure of doing that for a professor of geology in Trinity, who had the Chinese ambassador as in the audience for his talk about his work in China. That was a great experience for me.
Do you think that post, that you know, it stood to you, that it gave you it opened more doors in the future for you, and things that you
being in the academy?
Yes.
Oh yes, I'm quite sure it did.
But I have it doing degrees
in the meanwhile. Of course, I had the first thing I had to do was to get my master's. Well, the BSc, I got in first honours in the BSc, and that was a good start. And I got my master's degree the next year. And then 3 years later, I think it was, I got my PhD, the Doctor of Philosophy. And then I got my DSc, or Doctor of Science, on publication. I think I have something of the order of 60 publications. And
what was your first publication?
Oh, my first publication. Oh, it'd be hard to think, go back that far. But
you must know the very first thing.
Well, it was probably a publication in America, because I was very fortunate in that I went to America early in my life, to MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I applied for a thing called the FSSP, or the Foreign Student Summer Project. And the idea was that you had to write out 2 or 3 projects, research projects that you'd like to work on in the States. 65 people were invited over to MIT by the students of MIT, and they were, their entry to depended on whether they had facilities there for their project, for example. In my case, I had started working on things called microelectrodes. They're electrodes that you can put into cells. The tip diameter is about a thousandth of a millimeter, a micron it's called. And they're very fine glass electrodes, and they're just made and filled with electrolyte to make electrical contact with the inside of the cell so that you measure the charge across the cell. usually the tissues we use are muscle from the frog. Now, every cell in the body behaves like a battery. It's charged negative on the inside, positive on the outside. And this is the source of all the signals that pass from the brain to the muscles, or from the senses to the brain in the body, and all the activities that goes on inside the brain. All the electrical signals involved are generated by the movement of iron, sodium and potassium and chloride in the blood, between the blood or the what's called the interstitial fluid, the fluid outside the cell but between cells and the inside of the cell. So anyway, there, it turned out that there was a chap named Harge Enrich had worked with the man who invented the microelectrode, and he happened to be on the staff at MIT and in the biophysics department. And so I went to work with him. He accepted me as a student. And now there were two students from Ireland. There were 65 students in all from about 35 different countries. Some countries had up to four students coming over. Others, in our case, we had two. Some countries had only one. Israel had just one. And what you did was you worked on your project for 3 months, and then the fourth month was spent touring the northeast of this United States, because this this scholarship was open to both engineers and scientists. And you go to visit Firestone and places like that in the industrial area, or General Motors and so on. And in the scientific area, we went to Brookhaven, the National Laboratory for Radiation Studies. And that was the last month you spent there. And then it turned out that while I was working with Jenrick, he said, there's a man working down at Woods Hole in Massachusetts would like to meet you. And he is going to offer you a job. And I said, well, that sounds great. But I said, I haven't got the proper visa to take a job here, and I'm only over for a scholarship. And well, he said, I'm going down to collect some fish. I don't know what he worked on, probably lobsters, in Attlewood's Hole. And I'll drive you down if you'd like to come down, and we'll meet him. And I said, oh, sure, I'll go down. So I went down. At that time, I was engaged to be married. And when I went down to see him, he offered me a job in New York. He said, I work in the Rockefeller Institute in New York, and he said, I want somebody from Conway's department. Now, I haven't mentioned Conway yet, but that was
Conway?
Well, that was the first man that I met in biochemistry. I'm going backtracking
yes,
a bit.
Okay, yes. But it's very important to get the root of this.
Well, Conway, E.J. Conway, was undoubtedly the brightest scientist we've had in this country. A biologist, and he had some theories. He had a number of theories. Some of them didn't come off, but some of them were brilliant. And during the war, he corresponded with a chap named Frederick Donnan, who was a physical chemist and living in London, about his theories. And I happened to be one of the few that could understand what he was talking about, because apart from the fact that he was difficult to understand, he insisted on starting with thermodynamics, no matter what he was lecturing about. And he had a cleft palate, and it was very hard to catch his. Sometimes he'd speak very quietly, and I could understand what he was saying, and I made copious notes. And after a while, with the help of another man on the staff who happened to live in Rialto, another, he was ahead of me, Paddy Moore was his name. Paddy was a brilliant scientist, and Paddy helped me to understand by being a very good lecturer and teaching me about Conway's theories. Anyway, the theories are too complex to go into at the moment.
Oh, yes,
you
yes.
Know, but
but fascinating, I'm sure.
Yeah.
But were told that
this man
somebody
wanted,
was needed from the...
Yeah, well... He was really needed, I think, because this man felt that this man that I came to work with and or was offering me the job was Hungarian. And one of the things he did when he went up to Woods Hole each year was to go and work with another Hungarian named Albert St. George. And Albert St. George was a Nobel Prize winner, a distinguished man who was studying muscle contraction. And Chappo had his own ideas about muscle contraction, which I didn't really favour. I thought they were a bit way out, but he was determined that I'd go home and I'd do some work with him and then publish the stuff with Conway as a joint paper, so that Conway's name would be on the paper and it'd be more acceptable to the general public. Now, I went back to Conway. I published two papers while I was with Chappo over there. They had nothing to do with his theories. They just had to do with the work I was doing with Chappo. Now, this, I'm jumping a year ahead now. This was after MIT.
But
I took the job.
The job.
And I got married. I came back to Ireland, got married, and took my wife back to New York.
What's your wife's name?
My wife is Mary. She was Mary Kavanagh at that time.
Yeah.
And she was a woman that I met in Paris Distillery. It's a long story, but her cousin got a job as chemist in the distillery. And we were a very musical lot, and we were very much into looking at the latest LPs that were coming out at the time, because the LPs were just new on the market. And I got involved with the Gramophone Society new CD, and I was chairman of the Gramophone Society for a number of years. And while I was there, we used to get musicians and composers and that sort of thing to come along and give talks and about their music, their choice of music, the sort of thing you hear on radio nowadays. And one among the people I got one night was Milan Horvat. I think he's Slovenian. He was. But Milan came along and he gave us his choice of music on record and also brought his piano. He was conductor of the Ori Orchestra at the time, got a piano along to give us illustrations, and he gave us a great night. And as Mary's first cousin is living in the distillery, the obvious thing was to go to the distillery afterwards to celebrate. And at that time, I didn't drink. I only started to drink when I was 28, by the way. But I went along to the distillery, and we had a great night. A lot of the people who were at the recital were invited along, and Milan Horvat was invited. And we had a great night there. But
that was the beginning.
There was extramural activities just to show that I wasn't into the books all the time, that I had other interests.
But did Mary travel with you then to the States?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Yeah. Oh, yes. And she got a job with the Academy of Medicine over there. And her boss there was Iago Galston, who was a psychiatrist. And she worked on Central Park, or the Academy of Medicine was on Central Park. And I was over on the Rockefeller, where I was working, was over on the East River, York Avenue. And we lived just opposite it, which was very handy for us.
And did you find that getting your position with Rockefeller, that gave you, there was nothing like that at home that you could possibly have got into?
No, but it still didn't. I got into difficulties after that, and I'll tell you, the problem was this. I was useful to Conway, and Conway wanted me to stay with him, and Conway was nearing retirement, and I wanted to go for the chair in biochemistry, naturally, and he told me I wasn't to do it. I was to stay with him, and he said, if you go for the chair in biochemistry, I'll oppose you by all means possible. And
so he got a bit sour.
At that stage. But it turned out then that I wasn't known in college. I wasn't on the staff. I was working for the Medical Research Council still, so I had no standing in UCD at all. But it turned out that the competition for the chair was between two people, one of whom has recently died. Don Hingerty was his name, and he was a rugby player, and he was on the staff. And the other person involved was Michael Harrington, who got the chair. And Conway, Harrington was supported by Conway, and the opposition, Hingerty, was supported by the college. And Conway was able to get two bishops to come back from Rome to vote for his candidate and to settle it. But I wouldn't have had a look in anyway. It didn't affect my future, because I think I probably got just 3 votes on the academic council. I don't know. Well, how did I know? Well, I mean, you always have means of finding out results. You know, they're not supposed to tell you. But I know that I got 3 votes in the academic council, and the others got something maybe like a dozen or 16 each, something like that.
But what did you do then?
Well, I told Conway that I had told him, I told him I wasn't going to work with him, that I wanted the chair. And if I, and at that time I got a very good offer in America to be dean of the faculty of medicine in one of the universities. And I said I was going to take that. And he was very kind about it. I mean, he didn't hold it against me. But and it turned out that the medical profession in college, especially D.K. O'Donovan and Oliver Fitzgerald, were great helps to me in this. They didn't want me to leave UCD. And they said, there's a professor has just come back from the States who was professor of pharmacology in Canada, and he's going to take up the chair in physiology. And he's very anxious to get your services. And I would suggest you don't rush into this thing, but apply for the chair, apply for associate chair in physiology, which I did. Now, there was another candidate in physiology for the associate chair, and I got one of them. So I stayed on in UCD as associate professor of physiology.
So that was 1967. But really what gave you the benefit is that you were also a professor in a college in the States, weren't you?
Right. Oh, that was later. I was a professor in George Washington University, but that came in 1969-70, I think it was.
But for those few years, so you were in UCD now. Yeah. You're back in UCD as professor.
No. When I came back,
With that disappointment then in your life, really, when you were let down, were you content with what you had now in UCD at that stage?
When I got the associate chair?
Yes.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
You were, and you were quite happy to continue there.
Oh, absolutely, because the man that I worked with was brilliant insofar as he was a great organizer. And I had a high regard for him, I must say, Murnaghan. He was highly regarded. He was a difficult man to work with. So was Conway, if it came to that, you know. Conway was notorious. And I remember one time the Americans were coming to inspect his department. And Don Hingerty had gone on holiday, on his honeymoon.
Yeah.
And Conway managed to contact him and told him to come home immediately he was needed. Because Conway kept clear of teaching the undergraduates himself. He never lectured to me as an undergraduate. He was only lectured to me as a graduate. He only lectured to medical people, in other words. He didn't waste his time with science students.
Yes, indeed. So it was a kind of a love-hate relationship with yourself and Conway.
Oh, no, not quite. I mean, we had our disagreements. We had our disagreements, no question of that. Because he was very annoyed with me that I wouldn't fall in with his arrangements for my life, which was maybe not quite a reasonable. Anyway.
So, to move on from there then.
I was offered the job in surgeons, right? The College of Surgeons. And I took the job, and I was therefore a professor of biochemistry in surgeons. Now, my only duties there were to lecture. That was all. And so, in other words, I was doing my research in UCD with Conway, and I was lecturing in surgeons as a professor, associate professor of biochemistry. Then I got my appointment with UCD of associate professor of physiology. So for 1 year, my second year in surgeons, I was professor of biochemistry in the College of Surgeons and professor of physiology in UCD.
So you were in two
I was in two universities. But I was only getting one salary. I was getting a small allowance in surgeons, but that was only a token payment.
But a lot of energy and travelling.
No, 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 it wasn't, because we were in Earlsford Terrace, I think, at that time.
Yes.
And I was in physiology, sorry. Physiology at that time may actually have been in Marion Street. And College of Surgeons was just around the corner. So there wasn't a lot of travel.
The amount of students you were teaching, was the number. Yeah, mm-hmm. Was there, I'm talking about the late 60s now, was there a lot of interest in science?
Well, now, I was teaching, in physiology, I was teaching mainly medical students. I'd have a class of 120, maybe, medical students. About, Murnaghan was anxious that physiology wasn't a subject for science students at that time. But Morris Murnaghan was very keen that we should take in science students. And it was the best thing he ever did for the college. And when we started taking science students, we'd have about a dozen science students. And they had to be given different lectures to some extent. They could sit in for most of the lectures with the medicals, but if it didn't suit their program, as happened later on when they moved out to Belfield, then we gave them special lectures. And but they covered the course.
And these qualified students then, where were they going?
Science?
Yes.
Well, an interesting thing was the first two students we had in that class were girls who had done engineering and were the first people to qualify in engineering. And they went into rehabilitation medicine, because we gave them a crash course in biology after their engineering. And some of them went out to, where is that place now? There were people who had a foot in both camps. You know, prosthesis, for example. If you've lost a leg and that, you've got to have a leg made for you. And there are other cases like stents and things like that. These are all made by paramedics who are engineers or have done engineering, studied engineering. And their job is to help people who are disabled. Now, in that regard, the one thing that particularly interested me there was that we had at that time, we were a biology department in what was then the engineering school. Marion Street had been cleared of science people. They'd all gone out to Belfield. There were only the engineers left there and physiology. We got together, we formed the Biomedical Engineering Society, and I was a founder member of that. John Kelly, who was registrar at the time, I think, or subsequently registrar, John Kelly, who was a chemical engineer, he was one of the people instigators who started it, and also people like Paddy Fitzgerald, the surgeon. There were people who realized the need for some sort of coming together of medicine and engineering so that we'd be able to manufacture prosthesis and things like that, which would help people who would have, say, defective valves. One of the most interesting talks I was at that time was a film. And Paddy Fitzgerald, that's Oliver Fitzgerald's brother, who was a surgeon, gave the talk, and he showed a film of a heart operation in which a valve was replaced. And when the thing was finished, Fitzgerald said, "Now listen, if you stand close to me," he said, "you may hear that valve clicking," because I was on the table that day. I wasn't operating. He said it was my own valve that had become defective.
I'm going to ask you now about other avenues of the profession, I suppose. Forensic science, were you involved in that in any way?
No. I never had much to do with law, but we had a Department of Forensic Science below us in Earlsford Terrace. There was a Dr. Hickey there. And there is also, I can't remember now, the present man, the holder of the office. Dr. Hickey died some years ago. But forensic science, we're getting to the legal profession there, and it's not an area that I'm...
What about DNA, which was actually coming in your time?
I remember in the academy I was on two of the national committees. One was the National Committee for Biochemistry, and the other was the National Committee for Biology. Now, you could be on a national committee without being a member of the academy. But I think when I was on those committees, I was already a member of the Academy. That'd be in the 60s and 70s. And one of the things we had were dealing with in the biochemical area was recombinant DNA and that sort of thing. Really looking into the regulations that might govern use of these. But I never got deeply involved there because I found the National Committee for Biology much more interesting. Now, the reason I got onto that was that at that time I was working, I'd moved into physiology, I think, and I was in Merrion Street. And down the road from us in Merrion, in Trinity, it was only a short walk from Merrion Street to Trinity, I'd made contact with a chap named Jack Granger. And Jack was a member of the HEA, I think, or some important bodies at the time. And he used to come up, he was very interested in microelectrodes, and we used to cooperate in our research. And subsequently, we did further cooperation with another department in the physiology department. When we moved over to the terrace, we had people coming and sharing equipment with us there when we were doing a thing called patch clamping, which is another development of microelectrode. It's a very, very tricky technique in which you need very expensive equipment. We couldn't, neither college could buy it.
But did you, yes, but interestingly now in your time, which was the 60s, 70s, and 80s, did you see an advancement in, well, obviously equipment, but in the, I suppose, the thinking behind science?
Oh, well, yes, of course.
Or did it change much?
It has changed enormously and developed enormously. And one thing, I don't know whether I should mention this, but I came across a very strange situation within the last few months in which I found a book in the library in the Academy. It was called Human Nature. And I opened this book and I started to read it and I found it fascinating, absolutely fascinating. Now, it was published by the Royal Society of Edinburgh. And I thought, I've got to have this book because there were three things in it that really interested me and I was anxious to read more about them. One was evolution, the other was stem cells, and the third thing was the brain-mind connection. And so I went down to Hodges Figgis and I bought the book, as I thought, or ordered it. And I got a book that wasn't the same book at all. Now, the first one was edited by a chap named Malcolm Jeeves. And the second one was Malcolm Jeeves. The same title, Human Nature, same year of publication. But the second book was published in America by the Templeton Press. Now,
what was the difference?
The difference was that the American book was censored. It was only, the first book had 369 pages approximately. The second one had about 250. And all reference to evolution, stem cells, and brain mind. Well, I'm not sure about the third one, but certainly a lot of the stuff had been jettisoned or censored in America because it was for the American public and they do not like certain areas of science even mentioned in America. Now, recently I brought it to the attention. Now, this is off the record, by the way. I brought it to the attention of a chap that writes for the Irish Times, Revel. And Revel was shocked. I had a letter from him only this morning to say he was shocked to hear of this happening. Templeton Press is a... There is a certain attitude in America that science is anti-religious, which is not true at all. That if you're a scientist, you can't be... You must be an atheist. And that is quite incorrect. But this idea holes there. And apparently what happened was when Malcolm Jeeves went to America to the Templeton Press or suggested he may have sent the proofs over to them too to see whether they could publish it there, they censored it and they took all references to these areas out. So evolution is hardly mentioned, if it's mentioned at all. They don't want it.
How did you feel about that? I mean, were you upset?
I was tremendously upset because I, having started my studies in science in America and found them so effective in the area of science, to think that they were being scared off by what evangelistic Southerners, I'd say, in America, the Bush camp, if you like, was really very alarming, to say the least. And
but very conservative in their views.
Very conservative, absolutely conservative. Now, I have to say myself that I am a Christian and I believe in Christian values. But I cannot see how you can jump from one thing to another. I can't see a conflict between being a scientist and being a Christian. And that's the truth.
Now, was that book censored in Ireland in that when you ordered it, you got the American version?
I didn't order it. I'll tell you the story now. What happened was I got the American version, but that was Hodges Figures, apparently. There may have been something there, but they ordered their books from America, apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
And the book that they were sent was the American version of the book. I subsequently got in touch with the Edinburgh University, the Royal Society of Edinburgh, and I told them what had happened, and they were very shocked. And they said, I said, I want to order the book from you, and they sent it return mail, and I got the book I wanted. I got a copy of it, so I have both books now. And if anybody wants to look at them, they're welcome to. And they'd find that one is, the American version was, the title was Human Nature, subtitle was Psychiatry and Christianity, how they relate to one another. The first one had six sub-editors, I think, and they all dealt with different matters relating to those subjects I mentioned, which were taboo, apparently, in America.
But Roderick, could you tell me, with the learning and with the time you've spent in research and work in your field of science, it gives you an insight to a lot of things, to the way we are, to the way we live, to the way we the way the body reacts and things.
Yeah.
Does that kind of is that something that's frightening in that you have so much?
Quite the contrary. I think I...
Are you delighted with it?
I'm delighted with it because I feel not only can I understand how my body works, but my wife and son. My son, by the way, is living with us at the moment. He has problems. But, you know, if you're able to detect certain things... I'll tell you an incident that happened to us a few years ago. My wife was invited to the academy. When I retired as science secretary, Academy were kind enough to give me a medal. They gave other officers of the Academy medals the same year. My wife was sitting, we had lunch, and the president at the time was David Spearman from Trinity Physics Department. And my wife was sitting at the table, and I noticed she was looking rather agitated, and it turned out that the person beside her was leaning on her. And I looked over and I saw that his face was grey and he was actually dying in the chair. And I suddenly jumped up and I went over and I took him and put him on the ground and loosened his collar and so on. And he started to breathe again and his heart had stopped.
What
of course, they were all alarmed. Well, it's sort of an attack. Now, my wife has had this sort of attack herself twice since. On one occasion, she was with friends. She'd walked up to Spawell, gone in for a coffee or lunch or something. And I got a phone call to say they'd sent for an ambulance. She was unconscious. And I said, don't stop that. Don't get any ambulance. I'm going straight over. And I was over in 5 minutes, picked her up. She was coming out of her state of unconsciousness at the time. Her heart had stopped. It's a thing called vagal arrest. And... She came back to life. I brought her home and I have one of these cuffs for measuring blood pressure. You see, there is a thing. When you know about the physiology, you know what to do and you know how to do it because we use these cuffs on students and, you know, when we're teaching them to be doctors, you know, you have to, the heart is very important. And So I put the cuff on her, and her blood pressure was really dangerously low. And I said, look, take up the paper there and read it and relax a bit. And after an hour, I checked it again, and it was back up to normal.
But could you tell me, are you a religious person with
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so,
well,
I mean, the science and the religion.
Well, they're different. I won't say that I'm pious, if you know what I mean.
But what happens to the body? As soon as the body dies,
yeah.
What happens?
Well, I don't know.
I know, yeah, but have you ever experienced...
Do I believe
there's
an afterlife?
Yeah.
I think I do. I mean, there are a number of things that have happened in my life that would make me be a bit superstitious, I suppose, if you want to say that. Now, Richard Dawkins would say that is superstition. But a friend of mine, a very close friend, died. And I didn't know this person had died. And I was sitting out in the garden at home, and a butterfly landed on the paper I was reading. And I went to brush it away and didn't seem to want to go over it. And I thought, that was strange. And then I heard of the death. And then I thought, God, I wonder, is it a sign? Well, after all, I'm sure you've read Shakespeare and Hamlet. You know, there's more in this life than, meets the eye. But we as scientists are not sure of everything. You can go so far with science. I mean, for example, I would believe in evolution. And I have a friend lives near me at home, and he's a real, what I call, a right-wing Catholic. And what the Pope said is right. The Pope is infallible. Miracles happen. I'm dubious about a lot of areas of Christianity. But I do feel that basically I believe in a God. I believe there was a beginning. Everything was created. But I do believe also in evolution, because, I mean, the friend of mine who argues at these things says, oh, there are lots of missing links. You know, you can't link up. You can't say we're related to monkeys. That's ridiculous. But the DNA, 98% of the DNA is common to monkeys. I think it's not the orangutan, not the gorilla. One form of monkey.
Yes.
Is common to humans.
There is
a connection between them.
What about historical DNA? I mean, we've gone a long way in a couple of years where DNA was never properly used. Now it's been used in all kinds of ways.
And probably misused too. You know, it's a very complicated molecule. And like, you look for DNA, you're only looking at a little piece of a very complex molecule. That's another thing that I'd like to just mention here, that when I was a child, before I ever even thought of studying science, I went to the library in Thomas Street, as it was then, and I got out a book, and it was called What is Life? And it was by a fellow named Erwin Schrödinger. And that was the mathematician. And what Schrödinger was, he was ahead of his time, like Conway. What he was talking about was, what size molecule do you need that would be stable enough to carry a genetic code? He never knew about genetic codes, but he knew that information would have to be passed on from one to another, hereditary, mm-hmm. You know, if there was such a thing as evolution. I happen to know, actually, the great-grandson of Darwin, and I got him to give a talk in honor of Conway one time in Newman House. It was the 100th anniversary of Conway's birth. And at the time I was science secretary, and I organized a discourse, and Richard Keynes, as he is, came over from Cambridge to give the talk. And I only managed to have it published within the last year. It was published by the Physiology News in Cambridge.
Yeah.
It had to be shortened. I had to do the editing of it.
Your time in the academy, talk to me about that.
Well, I joined in 65, and I spent time on two of the national committees, and I was instrumental in trying to make a third committee. The two committees I was on, the National Committee for Biochemistry, I was on that. At the time, it was set up by a Professor Spencer from Trinity. He was the chairman of the committee, and he was the convener, and I joined it as a biochemist. So I was accepted, although I wasn't a professor at the time. Well, they had a general, there were no professors. so it didn't matter. I was on that committee. But I always felt that they only had one meeting a year, which wasn't enough, really. But they had a thing called the Irish Area Section of the Biochemical Society, because the Biochemical Society is mainly an English society, like the Physiological Society. Their base is in London or Cambridge, and they have Irish members, if you know what I mean. Same with the physiologists. Well, at any rate, this fellow Jack Granger from Trinity he suggested I join the National Committee for Biology, which I did, and I was a member of that for about 10 years. And during that time, what I liked about it was an interdisciplinary committee. In other words, it had microbiologists, it had zoologists, it had botanists, it had limnologists, it had various specialties of biology as members. And we organized a number of symposia. And the one that I was involved with, along with two other people, one was a chap named Arthur Went, who was from the fisheries department. You know, they weren't all academics. Some of them were people who were in public life, you know, or working civil service and things like that. Arthur Went, by the way, was a member of the Academy too, I should say that. We organized a symposium, and it was entitled Introduction of Exotic Species into Ireland, Difficulties and Advantages. And it was about introducing things like plants. Now, you know this rhododendrons. That was the best example I can take. Rhododendrons. They're not an indigenous plant. They weren't always in Ireland.
Well, they were brought in by a Kerryman.
Yeah, well, if they were, it was a terrible mistake. And we paid dearly for it, because it grows like a weed on the west coast, as you know. Both Kerry, Donegal particularly, the Glenveigh, is it? Glenveigh, I think it's called. They had to get rid of it because it grew so vigorously, and it could kill trees, and could eventually, I think its worst growth, I think, is actually on, island? It's not actually an island. It's in, I think it's in Clew Bay, is it? It is a terrible weed, yeah. And it has to be, when they want to get rid of it, not only do they have to cut it to the ground, but they have to cut it year after year, and then they have to poison the roots. And of course, poisoning roots poisons fish.
Yeah.
And that's a dreadful thing to have to. Well, I'm just giving you an example of the difficulties with. At the moment, we import loads of things. You know, everybody's interested in horticulture now. So, I mean, I have in my own garden, I have plants that came from China, I have plants that came from New Zealand, I have plants that came from, because I'm interested in gardening. I have bamboos, for example.
Yeah.
Now, bamboos are not indigenous. I have a thing called the ginkgo biloba, which came from China, and several other things like that. Now, these don't cause trouble, but there is always the possibility. Now, I remember I had to chair one of the meetings of this symposium that we organized, and I remember telling the story about America. They had in Florida carp in streams and ditches and canals and things like that. And the carp were eating the plants that were there, and the plants disappeared so quickly that they thought we'd get bigger and better carp if we changed the plants. And they introduced some sort of hyacinth from South America, water hyacinth, which they not only did it multiply, but it took over so much of the water that the carp disappeared. So then they thought, well, we'll have to get something that has a bigger appetite than carp. So they got catfish to get rid of this weed now that was in the streams. And the catfish did that, but they come out of the water, and they're, you know, like...
So one problem causes, you
one
know,
problem,
leads
yeah,
to another. Yeah.
Leads to another, you know. So you never know, when you bring anything into a strange environment, you don't know what is going to happen.
Yeah.
So I think that introduction of plants into Ireland should be carefully monitored from that point of view.
Yeah. Your project with Clare Island, you spoke about that at the very beginning.
Well, yes, I'll tell you a bit about that. Now, ex officio, when I became Science Secretary, I was also chairman of a committee called the IGBP, or the International Geosphere Programme on Global Warming. Now, that is a committee that I was very interested in it, but I discovered that my assistant there, no, I picked out one of the committee who was really brilliant, a chap named Sweeney, John Sweeney, and he works in the geography department of Maynooth, University of Maynooth. Now, Sweeney has appeared on television many times since that committee was set up, but I made him secretary of the committee. We hadn't got a secretary, and I said, John, will you take over as secretary? Because this is an area that I'm only coming into. I'm not that acquainted with the environment. And he took on the job, and he's done it brilliantly since then. Now, I was also ex officio a member of the Clare Island, Resurvey of Clare Island. I wasn't chairman. The chairman was a chap named David Cabot. And David Cabot was in the office of the Taoiseach and has since been sent to Slovenia. And eventually he was going out to Slovenia so often that he was missed from the committee. And I'd be asked, Roddy, would you take the chair? And I'd take the chair for those committees. And eventually they decided this also, little old Cabot, that they would suggest that he just drop out of the committee, which he did, and I took over the chairing of those committees. Now, Cabot did one very useful thing before he left us. He made a film about the Clare Island, the resurvey of Clare Island, and that was shown on television, and I made a copy of the thing at home. I know I'm not supposed to do that, but I just wanted to have some
for your own use.
For my own use, you know.
But anyway. The Academy has stood you well. You've managed, being in there, you have access to so much material.
Oh, well, yeah, but I don't always have the time to chase these around.
But
I
you have
some of them in Trinity and some of them in the Royal Irish Academy.
But before we finish, you're now involved, or you were? How long were you involved in the Temple Oak Telegraph?
8 years.
8 years, and were you the? Did it start?
No, no. I
eight
said,
years ago.
No. I'll tell you what happened. I wasn't talking to you about this, but it started as a youth project in Temple Oak, and then they got tired of it, and a family called the Heenans, Paddy Heenan, took over as a family project, and they ran it off on a Gestetner machine, and they just charged a very small sum for it. And my wife suggested I go to the community council meeting in, I think it was September 78, when I just had turned 50. And she said, you're not known in the area, go along and just have your speech, get to know them and contribute something. So I came home to her and I said, I have bad news for you. I've taken on the running of the Telegraph on condition that I can get a dozen people to help me. Or there were a dozen people on the committee. And so she said, I hope you know what you're doing. Well, I said, well, I'll probably be asking you to type stuff. But I'm not sure what it's involved yet. So anyway, we got 12 people. One of them, actually, the treasurer, our treasurer, happens to be the mother of Trevor Sargent of the Green Party, Mildred Sargent. And we got the 12 people anyway, and so we ran it since. And after 8 years, we began to find that we weren't getting as much material in, and there was another man in the area who was anxious to take it over. And he took it over. He didn't do a great job of it because he had MS, and he was in very poor health. And he couldn't meet deadlines, and for one person to take it on, but he wanted to make money out of it, and I think he made a mistake there.
Right. So but Roderick, this is a subject that I'm going to come back to, because I would like to talk more and more about your your time spent and all the material that you found and that you you came across, you know.
I want to just show you, just to bring you up to date on the Temple of Telegraph. This is a production of Heenhans, right? Let's see. I don't know if this is something else. But this is a production of Heenhans. That was a picture that appeared. Thaddeus Breen drew that. Thaddeus joined our committee by sending, he was an archaeologist, and he sent us about a dozen, or no, half a dozen ink drawings of structures.
And you published these?
And we published them.
Oh, sure.
On our front page. On our front page.
Yeah.
That page, by the way, that picture was drawn by Trevor Sargent, as far as I know.
Yeah.
And here is one of the...
You got plenty of support, so I bet you.
See, look at there. Thaddeus Breen.
Yeah.
You see, and that was a man that did all our front pages.
But, Roderick, I wish you the best of luck with this. But I'd love to record another session with you on it indeed, yeah. But for now, Roderick Kernan.
Kernan.
Thank you very much indeed.
Not at all.
Thank you.